Well, it's time now for another episode of Don't Pass Me By with me, Bob Wilson. We're on the Shake and Wake Network. We have our friend Robert Rosen on. He came on last time and he talked to us about his book, A Brooklyn Memoir, My Life as a Boy. It was fascinating. His other book is equally, if not more so, fascinating. They're both fascinating. Nowhere Man, The Final Days of John Lennon. It's been called one of the 10 most important biographies ever written. High praise indeed. Other people have said great things about it. One of the most sincere and brutal biographies ever written. That's kind of an intriguing quote about it. So, welcome to the show today, Robert.
Hi, Bob. Thank you for having me on again, and greetings from New York City.
Now, as we start in, we like to mention right at the start of the show, the way the book is being published now, where can people go to get a fresh copy, the latest release and such?
The latest release is the ebook, which came out in 2015, and they could get that anywhere ebooks are sold, Amazon, Apple Books, Barnes and Noble, any place ebooks are sold, you can get the latest copy. It's also available in paperback, but that's an old edition that came out in 2002. The ebook was updated, as I say, in 2015, and there's a lot in there that's not in the paperback, and I hope to one day get a new updated paperback out, hopefully soon.
Well, we hope so too. If there's anything new put in it, I'd like to update my edition. It's a great read. Now, as you were putting this out at first, before you knew what would happen, the book kind of became an entity into unto itself. It's a legendary book. A lot of controversy around it, which is, means there's good stuff in it to go back and forth on. But you put it out originally on Soft Skull Press, a New York underground entity. How did it wind up there, and why was that entity needed for a book such as your own?
Soft Skull, they published it. They published the original hardcover in 2000. And before Soft Skull picked it up, the book, I had written the book 18 years before it was published, and it was just rejected by everybody. That everybody was afraid to publish Nowhere Man for all kinds of reasons. They were worried about being sued. They were worried that, believe it or not, there was not enough interest in John Lennon. And they were worried that I did not have documented proof that what I was saying was true. And then in 1999, when Soft Skull made the offer and, published it the following year, I don't know what happened. Something happened, and Soft Skull made an offer for the book, and it eventually came out. And, after 18 years of frustration and people, not believing that what I wrote was true, that it was finally published. And it was, for me, it was a life-changing event. I went from being, an obscure freelance writer to having a bestseller in multiple countries and multiple languages. And Soft Skull did a good job promoting the book. And that's what happened. And then a couple of years later, a paperback came out published by a different publisher, Quick American Archives. And that came out in 2002. And then another an updated ebook edition came out in 2015. And, like I say, it's been out in Spanish and German and Japanese. There's something like, at this point, maybe 15 different editions out there in various languages.
That is quite impressive, to say the least. Now, basically, the story covers John's diaries from January 1st, 1975, to his death on December 8th, 1980. Now, you were friends, I believe you went to school with Fred Seaman. And how did Fred come into play to get you involved in this story with these diaries?
Well, right. What you say is correct, that I met Fred Seaman late 1973, or sometime in 1973, maybe early 1974, at CCNY in New York at City College. I was the editor of one of the school newspapers there, Observation Post, and Fred joined Observation Post, and we became friendly. I was the editor. He was a writer. It turned out he also lived down the block from where I was living a year later, and we just became friends. And his family, his uncle Norman Seaman, his aunt Helen Seaman, his uncle Norman went back with Yoko Ono to the early 1960s. He used to produce her performance art pieces at Carnegie Hall, and his aunt, Helen Seaman, was Sean's governess. And early 1979, the Lennons needed another assistant, and his uncle Norman recommended Fred for the job. It was the family business. He met Lennon. They got along. He was hired. And the day he was hired, he came to me and he said that, we're going to do a book about this, that, my uncle Norman, who, like I say, went back with Yoko to the early 1960s and was, friendly with John, that, he felt his uncle Norman should have done his own book, but he never got it together to do a book. And he just felt it was a family obligation to write a book about the Lennons. And, Fred admired my writing. I was, at this point, by 1979, I was a professional writer. I had written for various magazines like Mother Jones and Soho Weekly News and a bunch of others, a bunch of local newspapers. I was like a general assignment reporter for one of the local newspapers here, The Villager. And I had also worked as a speechwriter for the Secretary of the Air Force. And Fred just admired my writing from OP, from all these other places. And he wanted to collaborate with me on this book about the Lennons that he felt it was a family obligation to write. So when he came to me with this proposal, I said, oh, yeah, of course. I'd love to work on something like that. At the time, I had written all these articles, like I say, for magazines and newspapers, but I had never been able to get a book published. And I just thought that this book about Lennon was a great opportunity to publish a book. And, that's how Fred and I agreed to do this book back in 1979, February 1979.
Now, he proposed the book then when he got the job. And then, quite horribly, approximately a year goes by. And on December 8th, 1980, John Lennon is slain in New York City. From that event, how did his writings then come into your purview?
Yeah, well, it was actually 2 years. He started working for John in, February 1979, and then, John was killed at the end of December 1980. So the day that John was killed, the day after, he was killed at like 11 o'clock at night, New York time, on December 8th. And sometime the next day, December 9th, Fred called me. And he said, now is the time to begin working on this book that, we started talking about 2 years ago. And he told me the day after John was killed that when he was in Bermuda with John that summer of 1980, when John was working on the demo tape for Double Fantasy, John had told Fred that he had a premonition of his death, and that if anything should happen to him, to John, that John told him that he was to write the true story of his life, of his final years, and to use whatever research material he needed to write this book. And, you know, this was now the job that, you know, that Fred had asked me to collaborate with him on. And, you know, I was in a state of shock on December 9th, 1980, like everybody else. But I also saw that I was caught up in this historical moment that, you know, the assassination of John Lennon was comparable to the assassination of John Kennedy, of Bobby Kennedy, and it was just an historical moment that I had a ringside seat to, and I was thrilled to be able to collaborate on such an important book at such a historical moment. And, you know, from that day on, we went forward with writing this book.
Now, as you start looking at the writings, what's jumping out at you? Is it very different than you expected? You go in with no expectations. As you're reading, what are you coming across?
You're talking about John's diaries now, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, in December 1980, that we had agreed to do the book, Fred and I. And soon afterwards, we would get together. Well, first of all, you know, for the 2 previous years, I had been in constant contact with Fred, and he was always filling me in on, you know, what was going on with John and Yoko and Sean, and, you know, if he was in Bermuda or wherever he was with the Lennons, that, you know, he would call me and just, you know, give me a running account of whatever was going on. And then, you know, after December 8th, 1980, by the end of the month, I was going down to Fred's house once a week. And one of the things that Fred did for his job as his assistant, as John's assistant, was he took photos that he was just, he'd walk around with a camera and he'd take all these, you know, intimate photos of the Lennons at home, really, or, you know, the Lennons out on a boat or something like that. And they were slides, and I would sit down at Fred's house and he would show me the slides and I would take notes on them. And the first thing that I did as far as this project was I took, it was really several hundred slides, and I took them back to my place and I started organizing them and writing about them based on what Fred was telling me. So the first thing we were going to do was we were going to put out a picture book based on these photos that Fred had taken. And then it was Memorial Day weekend, 1981, like 5 or 6 months after John was killed, that Fred came to my house, and that's when he gave me John's diaries that covered 1975 through 1980. And yeah, he reminded me, you know, that this is what John had told him in Bermuda, that, you know, he was to use whatever research material he needed to tell the true story of his life, of his final years. And it was obvious from the moment I saw these diaries that, you know, this was the key to the project. It was not only the key to the project, it was the key to John's consciousness.
So you're getting into the diaries now. Had you been a big Beatles fan? I know you, you know, you've spoken to me about it before, so I kind of know the answer. But for the audience, were you a big Beatles fan?
I don't know if I would say I was a big Beatles fan. I was certainly a Beatles fan that, you know, I talk about this in A Brooklyn Memoir, that the first record album I ever bought was Meet the Beatles. And you know, I bought that the day after I saw them on the Ed Sullivan Show, like, you know, a billion other people. So, you know, I bought Meet the Beatles, and I played that record to death. I knew, you know, every word of every song on it. And, you know, over the years, I had accumulated a few more Beatle albums. I had, you know, Meet the Beatles. I had Sgt. Pepper. I had Abbey Road. I had the White Album. But the thing was, you know, when the Beatles first started, I thought, and probably a lot of other people thought, they were just some group who had some good songs. And that I thought that, you know, they were going to be a one-hit wonder, a two-hit wonder, a three-hit wonder, and then they just, like, you know, fade into oblivion like so many other groups. So, you know, I followed the Beatles for a couple of years, and then I forgot about the Beatles, and I got caught up in other things, like, you know, writing sports. And, you know, at one point in my life, I wanted to be a sports writer, and I just ignored the Beatles for a couple of years, and then, like, you know, 2 years pass, and then well, the Beatles are still doing it. They're still putting out albums, and I remember my uncle had bought the White Album, and I was not aware of the White Album, and, you know, I really hadn't been listening to the Beatles for some time, and, you know, I put on the White Album. I guess this was 1968, and I was like, what, 16 years old or something, and it was just, I was just kind of amazed that, you know, 4 years later, the Beatles are still out there recording albums and amazing albums, and then, you know, eventually, you know, in 68, 2 years later, the Beatles broke up, and I kind of forgot about them. You know, I didn't really follow their solo careers that closely. You know, I did not listen to Lennon much during his solo years. You know, of course, I heard Imagine and a couple of other things that they played on the radio. I actually, I listened to Paul more. I liked the album with, like, you know, Hell and Wheels on it. What was that called? Band on the Run. But no, you know, I did not pay that much attention to the solo Beatles. You know, if somebody had given me as a birthday present All Things Must Pass, the George Harrison album, but I didn't pay much attention to the Beatles. And then Fred got the job with John in, you know, 1979, when, like, the Beatles were very far from my consciousness. And one of the reasons Fred got the job was because he wasn't a Beatles freak. That, you know, he certainly knew about the Beatles, but, you know, he was not really a fan. So, you know, he, soon after we started working for John, you know, we'd hang out and we'd talk about the Beatles, and he would ask me questions about them because I knew more about the Beatles than he did. And I was surprised at how much I knew about the Beatles, how much I knew the lyrics, how much of the lore I was familiar with. I'm talking about, like, you know, he'd say something like, you know, what's this thing about playing Revolution Number 9 backwards? And I actually did that. I would play Revolution Number 9 backwards on my turntable. Which you could actually do by, you know, putting the, you know, 33 RPM, 78 RPM. If you put it between, like, two different speeds, you could spin the turntable backwards. And I would do that. And, you know, I was kind of caught up in the clues about Paul being dead. And if you spin Revolution Number 9 backwards, you will actually hear, "Turn Me On, Dead Man." And, you know, I knew about stuff like that. I knew, you know, that, you know, Who's the Walrus, you know, it's not, no, you know, John's just saying that. The walrus is not Paul. John is the walrus. You know, what does the walrus mean? I don't know what the walrus means. I think, you know, he was just taking an acid trip or something, and he saw a wall. But yeah, he would ask me all these questions about the Beatles, and I would surprise myself by how much I knew about them. And, you know, this was at the beginning of his employment. So, you know, that's what was going on, you know, all through 1979 and all through 1980.
Now, as you get into the gist of the story, some of which stirred up quite a bit of controversy, which things jumping out now were the things that the fans kind of got worked up about? It was another side of John we hadn't really heard about much. They'd built him up to be this, grand guru of peace and, semi-communist where, like you're saying, and imagine there's no possessions when he actually, I think, had quite a few if I check. But what kind of things were jumping out at you in the diaries?
Well, John was no communist. I could assure you of that. Yeah, he was very materialistic. He was, quite the opposite of a communist. He was, into money and, into possessions that, imagine is fiction. His songs were fiction. Or if they were not fiction, it was, something he might have believed at the moment and changed his mind the following day. But what was jumping out at me at the diaries, the main thing that was jumping out at me from John's diaries was how much he thought about Paul McCartney, how jealous he was of Paul McCartney, how attuned he was to Paul McCartney's music and his constant hits, and he was just basically obsessed with Paul McCartney and always seeing his life in relation to Paul's life, that he was either doing better than Paul or Paul was doing better than him or he was happier than Paul. And he would think about this, if not literally every day, just about every day. And, this is one of the things he wrote about in his diaries. And what really jumped out at me was in early 1980 when Paul and Wings were going on tour in Japan, and Paul was busted for marijuana coming into Japan, and he went to jail for, a couple of days. And
10 days in a Japanese prison.
10 days in a Japanese prison, and the tour had to be canceled, and John was deliriously happy that this had happened to Paul. And
God, I gotta stop there. He's getting news that his longtime mate, bandmate, and friend, is not just his records lower than his, but he's happy he's incarcerated. And at that point, we didn't know if he'd get out, so he's happy he's in a Japanese prison. Please go on. I didn't mean to interrupt, but I just wanted to belabor the point, which I'm so famous for.
Yeah, and, that he felt that Paul had told him, Paul had stopped in New York on his way to Japan. He had called John. He had suggested getting together and smoking a little weed. John didn't want to do that. And Paul told him that they were going to stay in the presidential suite at the Okura Hotel in Japan. And John and Yoko considered the presidential suite at that hotel their private suite. And he was just, outraged that McCartney was going to stay there. And, John and Yoko believed in a lot of occult things, including magic. And Yoko said that she was going to put a spell on Paul that was going to stop him from staying in their presidential suite. And when Paul was busted for the marijuana, John attributed it to Yoko's magic.
Now, can I ask, she spent, from when we had talked before, like, it seems she spent quite a bit of money to put all kinds of occult people on her payroll, even in trials that they had, serious trials over the Beatles, litigations and different things. And I believe even hired some, like you had just mentioned about Paul McCartney, but I think some even in court cases that they had, they were both involved in. How neck deep in this dark, dark business was Yoko?
How deep into the occult was she?
Yes.
She was very deep into it. They had a full-time tarot card reader on staff. They called him Charlie Swan. His real name was John Green. And he would do tarot readings on for Yoko every day. You know, sometimes if she was out of town or something, he'd do it on the phone. But, you know, she summoned him to the Dakota just about every day to do tarot readings. And, you know, he did tarot readings for John, too. And Swan, John Green, Charlie Swan, had accompanied Yoko to Colombia, the country in South America, to meet up with this witch, Lena. She was known as a powerful witch in Colombia, and Yoko paid her, I think it was $60,000. I forget the exact figure, but it was something in that ballpark. Yoko paid Lena $60,000 to teach her how to cast magic spells. And, you know, that was what John believed, that, you know, Yoko used what she learned from Lena the witch, the bruja, as they say in Colombia, to have McCartney busted in Japan. So, you know, they attributed that to magic. And, you know, like I said, they did magic, they did tarot cards, they did numerology, they did astrology. It's, you know, all this occult stuff. And, you know, they ran their lives according to that. There's this thing in astrology called Mercury retrograde, where it seems like the planet Mercury is going backwards in the sky. And I think that happens like 3 times a year. It lasts for a couple of weeks. And Yoko and John planned their whole year around Mercury retrograde. It's like when Mercury retrograde happens, everything that can go wrong does go wrong. Communications lost. You can't like reach people on the phone. Things come back. It's just, you know, it's a time that nothing important should be done during Mercury retrograde, and they plan their whole year around that, the 3 times that Mercury retrograde happened.
Now, you mentioned Charlie Swan, whose real name was John Green, if I got it straight. I'd read his book a long time ago, and in his book, he alleged that Yoko had to sign a contract with the bruja, as you call her, and that she was basically selling her soul in his book. And she told him to sign it, and he cheekily added, the only thing she didn't know is I signed her name. So it's just they portray themselves as these people-loving, peace-loving, you know, give money away to everyone else people. And meanwhile, she's running around, you know, halfway across the globe, plotting their life on the occult and paying a witch for this stuff and cursing Paul McCartney. So she wonders sometimes why people may have a hard time with her. You know, this is a little worse than when she goosed, you know, looked like she goosed Chuck Berry when he jumped when she was screaming on the Mike Douglas show. When she's warbling from a bag, I think these things just might kind of give you a negative connotation with the fans. What say you?
Well, it was Yoko, I think, who was more into the magic and occult stuff than John, though John was certainly into it. But yeah, there is that scene in John Green's book. I think the book is called Dakota Days, where, you know, they go to South America and they meet the bruja, you know, meet the Beatles. They met the bruja.
good luck.
And there's that thing about, you know, Yoko selling her soul. I really don't know what happened there. I don't know how much John Green's account of what happened can be trusted. But, you know, my sense from reading the diaries was that, you know, she just went there to learn about casting magic spells. And, you know, that there was nothing aside from John Green's book about selling her soul to the devil. Who knows, you know, it could have happened.
But he was there, so if he embellished it in the book, we don't know, but John didn't write it in the diaries. But just if you go by the diaries and what you read, indeed, John was attesting that she was basically neck deep in all this stuff. Because some fans will say, oh, it never happened, blah, blah, blah. But as far as his writings go, they were running their life according to this nonsense.
Yeah, well, the thing about magic that, you know, a lot lot of the stuff in the diaries, until I started reading up about magic and astrology and numerology and all this stuff, it didn't really make a lot of sense. When I started learning about it, then things started falling into place. Now, the thing about magic is that magic is real if you believe it's real. So, in other words...
Well, she obviously believed it was real.
So, in other words, if you think that a wealthy and powerful woman put a spell on you and you believe in magic, then magic is real. And they really seem to believe that they could use magic in their business dealings as just like a way to control people and events. And, you know, like I said, if you believe magic is real, then magic is real. If you believe I just put a spell on you, then magic is real. But I did not just put a spell on you, so don't worry about that.
Well, I mean, your outlook is basically what you described. Like, that's the way you see it. Like, in Yoko's viewpoint, she wasn't just messing around with something to screw with your head. Some of those things were done in secret, and people wouldn't even know about them. So she did believe this stuff was real.
Oh, yeah. Oh, she did believe that stuff was real. I mean, the whole thing, I mean, especially with astrology and the Mercury retrograde, that, yeah, she really believed that was real. But the other interpretation is that this was just one of the ways that she tried to control John, that, you know, John, it's Mercury retrograde. You have to stay here. We can't do anything. And, you know, maybe there is some truth to that. I don't know.
I understand, like, you've expressed that your opinion is it's on that level, but she seems to have believed it was real. Someone like me is more of a traditional religion person. I think I'd run from that, like, you know, like the blowing wind. But in any event, Yoko, in your book, we talked about when you went to the Wailing Wall and you had an experience in your last book, and that was a very excellent interview you gave on that show on the Brooklyn Memoir. But John also went to Jerusalem. He went on a trip, and basically Yoko sent him over there, and he was
okay,
out there.
Wait. Hold on a second. Okay, yes, Jerusalem. That is in one of the very early chapters called Jerusalem Fantasy. John did not go to Jerusalem and that whole thing. What that was my description. I used my imagination to imagine the kind of fantasy John might have. Those were the kind of things he thought about. Remember, when Nowhere Man was first coming out back in 2000, that these people, you know, Ono and the whole Lennon estate, they were out to stop the book. They did not want that book published. And I was on what I thought at the time was extremely dangerous legal territory, that I knew, you know, for one thing, I couldn't quote from the diaries. And, you know, people had been rejecting this book for 18 years. And now, you know, finally it's going forward. And I was super paranoid at this time. So what I did with Jerusalem Fantasy was to use a fictional technique to establish John's character and give me something to point to at the very beginning of the book to say, no, this has nothing to do with John's diaries. That's just fiction. And it was a legal thing, and it was a literary thing. That the main thing with Jerusalem Fantasy is, like I said, it established John's character. It showed the kind of things that was going on in his brain, but it also gave me legal protection. And, you know, then the book came out, and, you know, nobody sued me, of course. And you know, people were responding to it. And one of the things I kept hearing about, people really liked the Jerusalem fantasy chapter. And you know, I just want to make clear to your listeners and, you know, anybody who reads the book that the Jerusalem fantasy was, in fact, a fantasy. It was my fantasy of John's fantasy. The same thing at the very end. I got a chapter called Dakota Fantasy. It was the same thing. It's kind of my fantasy superimposed on John, you know, knowing what I knew about the kind of things that went through his mind.
Now, but was the fantasy at the start of the book about him going to Jerusalem? There was a point where John, near the end of his life, like he had said, the Beatles are bigger than Jesus, and, you know, he made different quotes for hyperbole, but there was a point where he was drawing close to that, and perhaps that's where your fantasy was derived from. And then I, from my understanding of it, Yoko came back in and, you know, shot that down fairly quickly, but he had recorded about six songs that were sort of traditional Christian type songs that
John recorded six songs that were traditional Christian type songs.
Approximately six. Yeah. One was called, Help Me to Help Myself. You can find right. them. They used to be easily found. They're like the only demos that Yoko won't release. He had seen a big mini series on TV. I had asked one of his bigger biographers, I don't mean compared to you. I mean someone who just has written like about eight volumes on John. They're going to do a nine-volume set. I won't mention them the name here because, you know, people get sketchy of Yoko. But she was one source where she's heard all the different songs. And he had written like about half an album's worth of these songs. There's still a couple on there. And then there's one where he kind of says, I'd listen to an evangelist on TV, and then he kind of poo-poos it. Because he'd been falling out of it, but he actually took Yoko and Sean to church in Manhattan at Easter. And then there's a letter purported to be written by him to Oral Roberts where he was questioning faith. They've never said it wasn't true, but the letter exists. Whether or not that was genuine, I don't know, but the songs on that topic were, you know, a fact. The number, I'd call it five for argument's sake, but they were pretty overt song. So it's very similar. It's interesting. That's why I thought your fantasy part was based on that, because that is something that happened. And you can imagine Yoko coming in with her tarot cards and numerologist and everything, finding that John was now getting interested in the Bible and such. And you know, she I guess did her work to pull him out of that, what was going on there.
Well, okay, what's not a fantasy, what's true, and this was spelled out in the diaries, and it's in my book too, was that at one point, I believe in 1977 or 78, that John was watching, you say Oral Roberts, my memory is that he was watching
there was another
Billy Graham's sermon.
And he also was watching, Pat Robertson, yeah. There was
yeah,
a few.
He was watching Billy Graham sermons on TV, and for about 2 weeks, he accepted Jesus. He was touched by the love of Jesus, and right. he was drawing crucifixes in his diary, and he was ending, like, you know, every thought with, thank you, Jesus, thank you, Lord. And, you know, he tried to get Yoko into it and, you know, get her to watch Billy Graham sermons. So, you know, he had this two-week phase where he had accepted Jesus. And one of the big shocks to me about the book was how the Christian media really glommed onto this thing about John accepting Jesus. And this, my story in Nowhere Man about John accepting Jesus, that this has become part of sermons that, you know, people use John as a good example of a bad Christian. And Christianity Today in 2000 picked Nowhere Man as one of the 10 best books of the year. This all just, like, completely blew my mind, because it was like the last thing I expected. It was just, you know, a brief chapter that John briefly accepted Jesus. But, you know, there is no question that John had a thing for Jesus in one way or another, that, you know, he was saying, you know, the way things are going, they're going to crucify me, and we're bigger than Jesus, and I've accepted Jesus. And, you know, then there's, you know, Bob Dylan having accepted Jesus, and, you know, Dylan writing, "You got to serve someone," and then, you know, John responding to Dylan's, "You got to serve someone," with, "You got to serve yourself." And, yeah, you know, Jesus is like a through line in John's life. But, you know, the Jerusalem fantasy.
The only thing I'd add to it is the songs like that my friend has heard, and I've heard some of them, were like Help Me to Help Myself. Another was called Crossing the River Jordan. And the story goes that he had bumped into missionaries, and he spoke to them. And then he saw one of the big, I'm trying to think of the name of which one, but it was one of the big television, several part documentary that would be, say, on NBC. And John saw that, and he wrote like half an album's worth of songs. So, you know, you saw the diary, so you would know if that was 2 weeks in that part. But I don't think he could write half an album in 2 weeks. Maybe he could, you know, at that point. But no, the songs were traditional, like traditional straight of the, you know, that genre of songs. And another was called Crossing River Jordan and Help Me to Help Myself are the two I can recall off the top of my head. And I just know they related. Yoko doesn't want any of this spoken about. And then, of course, when the media gets a hold of it, you know, and they do some of the stories on it, I don't know if they have the whole story. But, yeah, the letter that's purported to be real is Oral Roberts. Like, you know, I've seen that one. And the contents were, you know, and there were a few different involved in the story. But it was just interesting because of her occult beliefs. And then he had gotten into this for a time, and then she supposedly came back from a trip and did everything she could to nix it. So I just know, you know, the one thing is those songs were written, but they're like the only songs they don't release from the bootlegs, like, that I know of. Like,
yeah, so that is interesting. I was, you know, not familiar. I mean, I've heard of the song "Help Me to Help Myself." I've seen the lyrics. I didn't realize that was a Christian song, and, you know, that's just, you know, my perspective. I'm not really familiar with that kind of thing, but you know, John was obsessed with religion, not just Christianity, but, like, you know, all the religions that, you know, the song that was a response to Dylan's
Well, and then at a different point, Dylan put out Serve Somebody, and John put out Sarcastic Serve Yourself. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, he talks about Mohammed and Krishna and Buddha and Jesus. And, yeah, he was just he was fascinated by religion in an intellectual way, but, you know, also at times, you know, in a spiritual way, that, you know, he connected with these things briefly. You know, all of them, and, you know, one time or another, that, you know, he just had a connection with these people, like, you know, Mohammed and Krishna. Well, you know, Krishna was not a person, but, you know, Buddha and Mohammed and Jesus, they were people. And, he related to them.
Right. Now, at the Serve Yourself one would have been at a different point, but it's interesting nonetheless how he and Dylan had an interesting relationship. But another interesting fellow, Paul McCartney. Now, it was interesting when you had brought up, you know, the vehemence that they seemed to have for Paul at that point. In your book, there's an interesting section when Paul put out Coming Up, you know, Like a Flower, It's Coming Up. It's a very jaunty song. In the video, Paul kind of put on his old Beatle outfit. He looked very young, considering his age, when he put that on. You know, he had aged kind of well. He still looked like Beatle Paul. Now, you had been writing in the book that, you know, John got very mad because he felt Paul was calling for a Beatles reunion. How would John have felt about a Beatles reunion?
John made it explicitly clear in his diaries that he wanted no part of a Beatles reunion, that John wanted to go forward, and he felt that a Beatles reunion was going backwards. And, you know, he just wanted no part of it. That, you know, who knows what might have happened if John had lived. And, you know, if the financial incentives had just become, you know, too tempting. But in 1980, the last thing that John wanted was a Beatles reunion. And what he said about Paul in his diaries was that he loved Paul like a brother, but he just didn't like him.
Interesting enough, and not like him enough to want him in a Japanese prison. At that point in time, as you're going through the diary, what could you make of John and Yoko's marriage? And I'm going to stretch another one in because they might be interrelated. They might not. But that, and how was their marriage going? And there's a lot of talk about heroin in their relationship. Was that still active? Was that a part of his life? What was going on with all that?
Well, there's no question that John loved Yoko. And he wanted to be with her. And, you know, that he wanted to spend more time with her. But, you know, she was always busy with doing business. And, you know, he was frustrated that he couldn't spend more time with her. Yeah, they'd been married, I think it was like for 13 years by 1980. And, you know, things had gotten a little bit stale. And he was, you know, John was tempted by other women. You know, he had a powerful libido, and he was tempted by other women. He wanted to spend more time with May Pang, who, you know, he had a lot of passion for May Pang, and he wanted to spend more time with her. But, you know, he was married, and this was not the easiest thing to do. Occasionally, he was, you know, able to sneak away and see May, but that didn't happen very often. That it seemed to me that the happiest time in John's life was in early 1975, before he got back together with Yoko, and, you know, he was still with May Pang, and, you know, they had a nice relationship on all levels, and John carried a torch for May until the day he died, and he was just, you know, very frustrated that he couldn't spend more time with May. But, you know, there's, you know, like I said, there is no question that he loved Yoko. He needed Yoko. Yoko was the mother of his child, Sean, and he considered Sean a miracle, and John was thrilled to have, you know, a regular family, you know, him, Yoko, Sean. You know, all this made John very happy, but, you know, he stayed with Yoko because on all possible levels, Yoko was survival in terms of, you know, finance. Well, you know, mostly in terms of finance and just, you know, keeping his life together. That Yoko was survival, May was fun. He wanted both, and he couldn't have both.
Now, so he stayed with Yoko and et cetera, and they'd had Sean. And how was his relationship with his second son in comparison to that of his first son, Julian?
He had very little contact with Julian. He felt guilty about that. Sean, as far as John was concerned, was the best thing that ever happened to him. You know, he doted on Sean, that if Sean was, you know, if Sean was angry at him, you know, John was worried that he had lost Sean's love. He was worried that, you know, all the people he loved in his life, he somehow lost, you know, either through death or divorce. You know, he cared about Julian, but Julian was with his mother, Cynthia, in England, in Wales. And, you know, he worried about Julian, but he had very little contact with him. And what John, I think John's ultimate fantasy was that he would live in the same house with Yoko and Sean and Julian, they would all be under one roof, living together as a happy family. But you know, he just knew that that could never be because Julian resented Yoko and, you know, held Yoko responsible for breaking up John's marriage with Julian's mother, Cynthia. And, yeah, he just, you know, all that John did everything he could to be a real father to Sean the way he wasn't to Julian.
Okay, so we're going through. We know that he wanted Paul in a Japanese prison. He didn't want to get the Beatles back together, which would have been tough if Paul was incarcerated in Japan. I had heard, you know, George and John hadn't even spoken in 4 years. Can you go anything on about, like, we know the relationship with Paul, he loved him like a brother who he wanted arrested. But how about the other fellas? There was also the quiet Beatle George, and then there was Ringo as well. What say you about his relationship to the other fellas?
Well, like you just said, he had virtually no relationship with George. He was annoyed at George because when George wrote his book, I Me Mine, I think that he virtually did not mention John in the book. And you know, John felt that, you know, that he was the one that helped George with his songs. And he just written George off. He was annoyed at him. Ringo, he remained friendly with to the end. He met with Ringo a couple of weeks before he was killed, and he had agreed to write a couple of songs for the album that Ringo was working on at the time. And yeah, they were friends. That, you know, Ringo was the easygoing one. He didn't feel threatened or jealous of Ringo, and they remained friends.
Well, they did some, like, I think the most Beatly album after the breakup. Ringo put out an album called Ringo. And on the album, all four Beatles didn't play at once, but as many as three were on one song. And I think that one sounded, you know, the most like the Beatles. And then they put out another album, Goodnight Vienna, and John wrote the title track for that and played on it as well. And you can hear on YouTube, if you go on, you can hear John doing a demo for that. And it really, it sounds like the Beatles again. Like, you know, it was, I was going to say the magic, but I don't want to go back to that. But I kid. But you know, it was still there. Whatever they had in the studio was still quite potent. I think it's a real shame. My being a fan, I'd like to have seen them reconciled at some point and gotten them, you know, seen them get back together and do something. Like that one album kind of reminds me of Might What Have Happened. So it warms me, you know, to hear those songs. I love putting those albums on. So John didn't want the Beatles to get back together, and he was putting out Double Fantasy. He hadn't been doing so well in his solo career. There were some highlights to it, but it was nothing like what the Beatles had achieved. Or even, you know, Paul didn't reach Beatle heights, but he'd been doing pretty well. What do you think John saw for his career? Like, he had just gotten out of a huge recording contract, I read in your book. First time in 15 years you'd written that he wasn't beholden to a huge company. You know, Capitol was gone. He didn't owe them anything, and he was free in a sense. But what do you think John wanted to do? Had John not died on December 8th, 1980, how do you think this might have played out in your mind? Because you've seen so much of it and saw how he thinks in his diary. What do you think John might have turned, and what might have happened if you use your imagination in that one?
Well, I don't think you have to use your imagination that much because, you know, at the point that John was killed, that there were plans in the works to go on tour and promote the album, because, you know, that's what you do when you record an album, is that, you know, you go on tour and you promote it. And John was kind of, I don't know if shocked is too strong a word, but he couldn't believe that, you know, after all these years of not touring and not doing anything like that, that they were getting ready to tour again. And, you know, he seemed to have mixed feelings about it. I mean, you know, he kind of liked the idea of having another hit album and, you know, hit songs on the album. I guess, you know, Starting Over was a hit. And, yeah, he was prepared to go on tour. I remember Fred talking about this, that, yeah, he was going to go on tour with John Lennon and, you know, do his personal assistant thing. But, yeah, he was, you know, he was absolutely thrilled and excited that this was going to happen. So, yeah, you know, John was going to go on tour and promote the album. Beyond that, who knows? You know, there were references in the diary where he would just, again, like to, you know, drop out of it completely, let the media focus on Yoko. You know, Yoko at the time of the murder, she was in the studio recording her own songs, Walking on Thin Ice. He was, you know, content with the idea, you know, let the media focus on Yoko, let him fade into the background. That, you know, if John had lived, if John was like, it'd be like 80 years old now. If he had
1940 to 19, be what, almost 82, pushing 82, right?
Yeah. Who knows what he would have done, but, you know, I don't think he particularly wanted to tour. I don't think he was sure what he wanted to do. You know, that his diaries struck me as a rough draft of like this tell-all memoir that he was going to write. And, you know, maybe that's the direction he was going to go in. You know, maybe he was going to do a tell-all memoir. But, you know, I just think that, you know, he wasn't really sure what he wanted to do, you know, beyond, all right, you know, he has to do this tour. I don't, you know, he wasn't crazy about the idea, but he was going to do it. And, you know, he felt too that, you know, he was comparing himself at the time to Bruce Springsteen and the Cars, and, you know, saying things like, you know, I could never be hot again like Bruce Springsteen and the Cars. So yeah, I think he would have gone off in a different direction. That, you know, then also the first posthumous album, Milk and Honey, that, you know, there were all these songs that had not made it onto Double Fantasy, like we keep talking about Serve Yourself, that, you know, that had not made it onto Double Fantasy because it wasn't the right message. And, you know, he felt, and he said explicitly in his diary, that he felt that that Double Fantasy was a mediocre album. And the reason that Double Fantasy was a mediocre album was because he'd left off some of his best material. I think Serve Yourself was an incredibly powerful song. You know, that would have just absolutely blown people's minds had they heard it in 1980. That Living on Borrowed Time, you know, that ended up on Milk and Honey. He never finished the recording. I Don't Want to Face It. You know, these were all, you know, really good songs that had they not been trying to send this message of, you know, the happy house husband, you know, baking bread, that, you know, they would have put some of the songs that he never completed that ended up on Milk and Honey, on Double Fantasy, and it would have been a much stronger album.
Well, if they would have cut Heart Songs off and put his other songs on, it would have been good. I'm not speaking for you. I don't want to dig you into the hole, but I mean, if they would have cut her, you know, Kiss, 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 Kiss Me, Darling, and these things off and put his other songs on that came on the later album, you might have had something.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of good songs. You know, in my opinion, there were two really great songs on Double Fantasy. One was Losing You, which is a song about Mercury Retrograde, which we were talking about before, and Watching the Wheels, which was inspired by Fred's uncle, Norman Seaman, that when, you know, John was in his years of seclusion, he would occasionally meet Norman Seaman for lunch. And, you know, Norman Seaman would, you know, tell him, you know, John, you're crazy. You got to get, you know, back into it, or people are going to forget about you. You know, you got to stop doing this and, you know, get out there and make music. So he comes home from his meal with Norman Seaman, and he writes in his journal, "People say I'm crazy. A song is born." And a couple of years later, that was the first line of Watching the Wheels. But I'm getting off on a tangent here. You know, we're trying to figure out what John would have done had he lived. And, you know, again, that's the, you know, great unanswerable question. You know, I think he would have been.
Well, you, Robert Rosen, have looked into this stuff and you've seen, you know, some of his inner thoughts in a deeper way in these writings and such than we have. But I just can't picture that, you know, had he lived longer, which would have been wonderful. You know, no, but it was horrible the way he went out. I would have to say, from whatever my view is worth, I couldn't see them staying together until now. I think at some point they would likely have gotten divorced. She was also quite a bit older than him, I think about 7 or 8 years. But I know it's speculating, but, you know, it's a radio show. We're not putting this down. It's not going in a time capsule, at least that I'm aware of. But, I mean, like, so just off the cuff, do you think they would have stayed together?
Yeah, I do. My sense is that they would have stayed together.
Are you saying that because you're afraid of the litigious Yoko? Are you saying that because you really think they'd be together? I'm kidding around, but continue.
Yeah, I think they would have been together because to have gotten divorced, you know, would have been, you know, just to untangle the finances and, you know, just all the massive headaches, legal and otherwise, that getting divorced, you know, would have caused, would have kept them together. And, you know, he was really dependent on her emotionally and financially, you know, that she did all the business stuff. He wanted no part of that. He despised the music business. He despised having to deal with Apple Records. She loved doing it. You know, that they would have stayed together for those reasons. That, you know, maybe it would have become a marriage of convenience at some point. But, you know, Yoko was survival. John needed Yoko to survive. And, you know, as of 1980, he loved her very much. And, well, know, again, who knows what would have happened 40 years down the road.
But when the Beatles were breaking up, like Paul McCartney said, you know, John came into a business meeting and he announced he was Jesus Christ. That's an interesting take on a business meeting. And then, and not, you know, as a joke. I mean, he was, you know, kind of out of it. And then in Let It Be, there's an outtake where, again, I'm saying these things. I'm asking Robert. Don't blame Robert for this. But, I mean, in Let It Be, there was one outtake where Peter Sellers came in and said, you know, John had a heroin kit out, like a needle and, you know, the accoutrements that go with it. And Peter Sellers said, you know, I just got in great trouble for this. You might not want to be so flippant. I'm paraphrasing. You better put that stuff away. But John had been shooting up with Yoko. And then Yoko said on camera into the film, into the camera, and then the film records it. But she said, you know, heroin is all exercise. Like, I mean, when they broke up, I was under the impression, and other people have said it, that, you know, from a layman's point of view, that John had been, you know, under so much drug use with acid, and he washed color out of his vision, and then he'd been, you know, using heroin. And basically, it almost seems like the guy had a breakdown, and he just had, you know, wanted someone to take care of things. And then she also was using a heavy drug. And then, you know, and then that was sort of what seemed to glue them together. I mean, it's kind of an ugly story, you know, that I'm laying out, but I just get, you know, she's so mad about how people view her. But I mean, John, you know, left his first wife. Yoko had been pregnant. If his wife had known that, you know, his first wife, that could have helped her immeasurably in court, I'd assume. And then, you know, all the heroin use, she horribly had lost several children, they attributed that to being, you know, using heroin. That's horrible. You know, I feel terrible that that happened. But she really hasn't done anything to win the fans over and such. Like, I just saw someone who kind of enabled John and tried to become a rock star. I'm being kind of candid. And then, you know, she wonders why people didn't really like her. I just didn't find much, you know, to like in his behavior. It's their personal life, but he's a public figure, you know, so to speak. But I haven't really seen much redeeming about her. Taking back property from his relatives after he passed away was another one. Just what do you make of what I'm saying there? You can distance yourself from me if you wish.
You know, it was, what do I make of it? Yeah, they were married. They, you know, had a private life. I'm not going to be one to criticize somebody's marriage. It's certainly true what you said about heroin. I mean, that was one of the many bonds between them. That, I mean, I've met Yoko. I've, you know, spent some time with her. I got to know her a little bit. She could be a charming woman, as for what goes on behind your back, you know, that's another story that, you know, I could understand what John saw in her. Yeah, that my taste for her art and her music, yeah, she did a couple of good songs. You know, some of her whimsical art has its merits. I'm not a great fan of it, but, you know, that's all subjective. And, you know, what you say is true, too, that, you know, Yoko has fans. You know, Yoko inspires people. You know, some people consider Yoko a great artist. I'm not one of those people, but, you know, these are people whose opinions I respect. And, you know, but, you know, what you say is true, that she has not done herself a lot of favors, you know, reaching out to John's fans or, you know, making herself palatable to a lot of John's fans. I know when Double Fantasy came out, and I heard this over and over again, that, you know, people would re-record the album and just take Yoko's songs off it. What am I saying? You know, that she's his widow. John loved her. She's the one who's in charge of the Lennon estate. And, yeah, she is free to do as she pleases. And I'm not going to criticize her for, you know, doing anything she might have done after John died.
Well, it's not so much that I mean to criticize. It's just that they've come out, and sometimes part of the point of view is, you know, it's she's been treated so mistreated. But if you go through the laundry list of things that a fan or someone who follows their career spends money to have bought, you know, their releases, their records, their T-shirts, their books, their stuff, you know, people have a say in who they idol worship, you know, and in a sense. And then, you know, when they come out and say, well, gee, what did she do? You know, like George Harrison had come out and said that they had, you know, she introduced him to China White heroin, which is when he really fell apart, according to what he had said. And, you know, although the Beatles might have broken up anyway, I don't know if they would have broken up if he hadn't been a heroin addict. You know, someone else could come in. The great thing is there's so many opinions about what happened, but it is like a Richard Burton, you know, Elizabeth Taylor kind of story. It's the gossip is part of the fodder. It definitely brings attention to them and has sold, you know, sold merchandise for them. So it's not, you know, I don't mean to castigate one human being. Is, you know, everybody's life they'll answer for someday and the way they've lived it. And it's not, you know, we're not going to judge that, but I just mean it's a public forum, you know, and the books are kind of about that. So many have been written. Yours has had, you know, a source that makes it really stand out, you know? So I just wanted to pick your brain on some of the things that took a little more daring for me to go into that people would say, you know, they defend the image right away. You know, we're all just people. And obviously there were some dents in their armor. I mean, and you know, the fans, if you're going to take their money, you also have to take their fill in your own word, you know, at some point, you know, and those are things, I think they're the harder questions, but I think they're some of the ones that people wonder about. Does that make sense?
I know that people who know Yoko a lot better than me, a lot better than I do, and I'm talking about Fred Seaman, I'm talking about the guy that they call Michael Tree, Mike Medeiros, you know, Mike Tree, I wrote about him a little in the book, that, you know, they know Yoko a lot better than I did, and they do not have a positive impression of her. Mike,
well, a lot of people, I don't mean to interrupt you, but a lot of the people that worked for them said that she was quite a handful, to say the least. Then it's
she
just with this image of being Gandhi or something, you know, it's just like, you got to be kidding me. You know, I mean, they foster this image of this, you know, grand guru of peace, you know, and John was quite human.
Yeah. And, you know, that is what comes across in Nowhere Man, that, you know, John was a human being. He was, you know, anything but a saint. Yeah, you know, he was a very talented human being who, you know, wrote some great songs and, you know, was a wonderful performer. But no, he was not a saint. And yeah, I'm a little turned off by the idea that Yoko, you know, tries to, you know, portray John as like some Disneyfied saint. When I met with her and we first talked about the diaries, that, you know, she told me that John's diaries are sacred. I don't think they're sacred. I think, you know, like I said before, I think John's diaries were a rough draft of a tell-all memoir that he would have written had he lived. So I disagree with that. I just, you know, Yoko rubs a lot of people the wrong way.
It's hard to figure out who she is because all you see are these things that happened. She never really sat down and addressed any in-depth questions about any of these things.
Like what?
Like before or after. In other words, like she never did a tell-all interview. Like she has with right been treated as a grieving widow. Certainly don't take that away from her. What his death was horrible. But she's never come out even years later and addressed any of these things. You know, like, well, you guys were, you know, into heroin. How did that affect you? I mean, they're the ones that are into the truth and they want to push everything to the limit. They want to give you the full picture. But yet they're covering up like most of their life. It seems like kind of hypocritical. So as someone who's followed them, I'd like, you know, you guys are so into heroin. How did it affect you? You know, when the Beatles did break up, what was really going on? Did John's drug use contribute to that? You know, were you concerned about his mental health with the amount of drugs he'd done? How do you feel about how his first wife was treated? You know, any of these questions, why, you know, if you're such a loving person and you care about the planet being, you know, in Mercury retrograde with, you know, things set the right way in the sky and, you know, the wind blowing the right way with feng shui, it's all above me, you know, nothing to do with that stuff, but there you go. It's like she never answers any of these questions. She just poses. Like, I've never heard her give an interview where she's done anything but talk about her movie with Heinies, Bottoms, whatever you want to call them, and all this other nonsense. But she's never really come out and opened up and done anything like a tell-all interview.
Yeah, well, she is trying to preserve the image of John as a secular saint, as a sacred person, as a cuddly Disney character, that she has chosen to go in that direction because she feels that, and it's probably true, that that kind of image sells more than, John, the crazed drug-taking rock and roll star. A lot of people, like Mike Medeiros in particular, are very angry at her for a number of reasons. The most relevant reason now is because, Mike has written a very good book about his relationship with John, that Michael and John, that he was hired as somebody to take care of John's plants and trees, and he became kind of a jack of all trades around the Dakota, and because they were the same age, that John and Michael became friends, that John had gone over to Michael's house, to visit him and hang out and see his artwork. And Michael wrote a book about this, and Yoko is doing all she can to prevent the book from being published.
What in the
And
book does she not like?
I think just the idea that John and Michael were friends. That Michael,
Well,
that,
you would think this lady's so into all these things, she might be into free speech. I mean, is it really going to hurt her that this guy puts out a small book that would mean a lot to him, that in her empire of, $500 million or whatever, that someone who knew John, got to, I don't want to say cash in because he knew him and he was friends with him, but in a sense, he gets to tell his story and his own footnote in history. Like, why should this bother her so much? Like, what do you got to cover up? It's like the mafia. It just seems like she's got these lawyers and.
I don't even think it's a question of covering up. It's a question of she wants to control the narrative, and she does everything she can to control the narrative. And I mean, I've become pretty friendly with Michael in the past year or so, and he tells me a lot of stuff. And one of the things he says is that at one point, Yoko threatened to fire him because she didn't want him talking to John. And it was not like, he was talking to John. It was like, John was his boss too, and John would say something to him, and Michael would respond. And she didn't fire him for that, but she threatened him, and now she just does not want Michael publishing a book about his friendship with John.
Well, isn't that
She's
his
able.
choice? I mean, it's free speech. So it's kind of like all we are saying is let Mike Tree publish his book.
I mean, I think, Mike should be able to publish his book, and I hope, he's able to do that someday soon. Me too, that she did what she could to stop me from publishing Nowhere Man, and there's just all these threats, and they threatened to arrest me at one point for criminal conspiracy. It was just, a threat. They were, doing what they can to stop me from telling the story I told in Nowhere Man. I was frustrated by this. It took me 18 years to find a way to get around it. But, I did get around it, and, the book came out, and, the heavens did not fall. But, I got the book out there that, in a lot of ways, Nowhere Man is the memoir that John was working on in his diaries that he never got the chance to complete. And it gives the reader a sense of what that memoir might have been. And she tried to stop me from telling this story. Fred Seaman, she was able to shut down, that she forced his book to go out of print, after it was in print for several years, for many years. And some of that was Fred's own doing. That, one thing that Fred has in common with Yoko is that in many ways they you know, Fred seems to be his own worst enemy, and in many ways, Ono seems to be her own worst enemy, which is, you know, what you talk about when, that there's just, you know, all these people who don't like her. There are good reasons for that.
Well, I agree with you. And then I just think at some point, if that, you know, she could have come out and given like a mea culpa or like an in-depth interview where she answered some of these questions. It's just like, what do you got to hide? You know? And then, you know, these people who lawyer up and they're worth so much money, it's just like, you know, and then they put out this tripe, like Imagine, and it's really so far from anything that they would actually be living. It's like, you know, it reminds me of last week when, you know, the people were complaining, you know, and what was it? What's the name of the island off the coast where they just, you know, they had 50 people come in and they were bussed in and they couldn't get them off the island fast enough. It's just like that kind of hypocrisy. It's like you're worth $500 million. These people have spent all this money to buy your records, you know, and the people that work for you, you know, and such, you know, get treated like peasants, you know, that John always used that word a lot. And uh-huh. they treated them quite horribly. And then when they don't like a little publicity, they lawyer up like they're the mafia. And really, you know, all that they were when it started out, it's four guys, you know, who played in small clubs. And then sometimes they even had to sweep up when they were done. And just it's quite, you know, quite a road that they walked down and a place that it ended up. But I don't know if she's done anything privately. Martha's Vineyard, that was the one this week. It was like people got a little, you know, it was ridiculous. At Martha's Vineyard, thank you, Steve. You know, all of a sudden they went after, there was 50 people bussed in who had come over the border. So they put them into, you know, they called out the National Guard. And it's just kind of the same thing. It's like with this, it's like, she's worth $500 million. And then this is the way they react to petty gossip. So I just thought it was interesting. I think your book is fascinating and there's no other book like it that was out there. And tell everybody please where they can find it again and get to it and any new editions that might be coming out.
Yeah, the Nowhere Man, The Final Days of John Lennon is available everywhere. Books are sold. Again, the latest edition is the ebook, which you can find, you know, anywhere. Ebooks are sold on Amazon, of course, Barnes & Noble, Apple, Kobo, Scribd, is that what it's called? You know, just any place that they sell ebooks, you can find Nowhere Man. And I hope in the not too distant future that there will be a new updated print edition.
I hope so too. And I just want to say it's been a lot of fun talking to you about A Brooklyn Memoir. It's been a lot of fun talking to you about Nowhere Man. I think you're an interesting cat, as they might say in the parlance of the 60s. I look for anything further that you might have coming out. I hope you'll come on again in the future. And I want to thank Steve for producing for us and doing a great job there and giving me peace of mind with the show so I don't have to worry how all these technical things go. And I hope we will see you again, sir. An excellent job on your work.
Okay, thank you very much for having me on. And yes, I look forward to coming on again in the future.
And we look forward to having you. Thanks, you're a fascinating guy. I hope the show is interesting. And if anybody gets mad at any of the comments, aim them at me because we know that you kind of deflected there and you were on your best behavior. So you can write any hate mail to me. So thank you for being on.
Okay, you're more than welcome.
Good night.